content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Brandy Spragata for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from Oprah Magazine. Our first article by Samantha Vincenti is titled, Being Colorblind Doesn't Make You Not Racist. In fact, it can mean the opposite. The international protests over the deaths of George Floyd, Breonna Taylor, and Ahmaud Arbery have just begun to spark positive change, pressuring states from Minnesota to California to rethink how they'll fund law enforcement and address police brutality in the future. The long-overdue outcry over the ways Black Americans have been mistreated, underserved, and underpaid has also effectively strong-armed many non-Black people into having tough conversations about race and racial inequality in the U.S., often for the very first time in their lives. Unfortunately, however, I can say firsthand that some people still really don't want to talk about it at all. They'll be the first to tell you they don't have a racist bone in their body and they don't care if you're white, Black, purple, or blue, etc. In fact, they say they're colorblind, meaning they don't even see race. And that refusal to see it often goes hand in hand with an urgent desire to stop discussing racial disparities as soon as possible. The current Facebook debates amongst my 40-something, overwhelmingly white former classmates in the Connecticut suburb that I lived in as a teen are, to put it mildly, a roiling cesspool of feelings. Insults are hurled, former crushes defriended. One woman's patient explanation of how the redlining housing policies of the 1930s have had lasting effects on economic inequality is rebuffed with angry insistences that the concept of white privilege is actually reverse racism. And then one day, to my pleasant surprise, I saw an article about how 1,100 people in my old hometown gathered for a Black Lives Matter rally on the town green. This peaceful show of support caused several longtime white male residents to absolutely lose their minds. The ignorance in some of my former classmates' posts didn't shock me. As a white Latinx woman who doesn't look Puerto Rican, plenty of people felt safe making ugly remarks in my company throughout the 5 years I lived there. What did surprise me was how quickly those who identified as colorblind became panicked or even furious when their neighbors started wondering whether racism had been living in their own backyards and town greens this whole time. To better understand how colorblindness connects to bias, and counterintuitively helps to upload racism instead of rendering it powerless, I spoke to two people who literally wrote the book on the subject. Sociologist Eduardo Bonilla Silva, author of Racism Without Racists, and Megan Burke, author of Colorblind Racism. The concept of colorblindness flourished after the Civil Rights Movement. I'm not the first one to say this, but for many white folks, being labeled racist is among their worst fears, Burke says. And as we're continuing to learn in this country, for many people of color, Black folks in particular, their greatest fear is not surviving an interaction with a police officer. So we're really talking about very different worlds of experience. Burke says the roots of colorblind racism were largely well-intentioned. It borrows right from that last third of Martin Luther King Jr.'s speech, where he says that he wants people to see his kids for the content of their character, not the color of their skin. So I think it's easy for a lot of well-meaning white folks to hear that and say, well, gosh, okay, yeah, I don't want that to be the primary lens that I use to judge people's character. In order to understand how colorblindness winds up denying the lived experiences of other people, Burke continues, it's also important to get clarity about what is meant by racism and some of the unintended harm that a colorblind framework can cause. To do that first requires a basic understanding of how Americans, and particularly white Americans, think about racism and the big way sociologists believe that's evolved over the past 150 years. From the late 1800s to the mid-1960s, the system of racial segregation and oppression known as Jim Crow made it illegal for Black Americans to have the same social and economic rights as white Americans. When we see photos of the Black students who comprise the Little Rock Nine face down hordes of angry white people just to go to school, No one debates what that is, blatant hate. The practices of domination were in your face. The ideology was overt, says Bonilla Silva. After the civil rights movement of the 1960s brought some positive change, he says, those who weren't directly impacted in the years that followed, such as those in suburban white communities, could easily choose to believe that America's big, ugly, racist period was a thing of the past. Pointing to 40 years of data, Bonilla Silva says that racism instead became embedded in what he calls now-you-see-it-now-you-don't type practices that are harder to call out, which conveniently makes it tougher to pin them squarely on discrimination. Bonilla Silva uses the example of a realtor who's been told they can't talk about race. If a person of color, such as himself, tells that realtor, hey, I want to live in a mixed neighborhood, the response might be, hey, don't talk about that. I don't see race. We're all humans. Instead, we steer people into different neighborhoods, a black neighborhood, a Latino neighborhood, a white neighborhood, so you don't need to talk about race to produce racialized outcomes. Not seeing race denies systemic racism. As everyone is steered into unofficially segregated parts of a city or town, it can be easy for those in white-majority communities to never think about the laws, zoning, and social policies that promote gaps in education and wealth equality along racial lines, particularly if they're only interacting with those who look like them and who share similar worldviews. Burke says the wish to believe that everybody has an equal shot at success is deeply tied to our collective American belief in individualism, or the habit or principle of being independent and self-reliant. In the individualist way of thinking, problems like poverty and health problems are cast as personal moral failings that can be overcome, not symptoms of a larger broken system. If you do the right thing, you'll be successful. If you don't, it's your fault, is how Burke describes that logic. But then that usually gets into the land of what, I emphasize, are often imagined cultural differences. It's because of people's culture that X, Y, or Z happens. Burke's description echoes what I've been seeing from certain white classmates on my timeline. Clumsily vocalized beliefs that people who live in areas with elevated crime rates and lack of access to supermarkets must not mind it that much, or else they'd work harder to move somewhere nicer, such as my classmate's own neighborhood, for example. If someone believes they've solely earned every success in their life through hard work, considering the advantages that may have greased their path upsets that long-held self-belief in their own merits. In the so-called race of life, if one group begins 50 yards ahead, members of that group are more likely to win, says Bonilla Silva. Individualist thinking also often blames anti-black violence, such as police brutality, on a villainous person, such as Derek Chauvin, the police officer who murdered George Floyd. In that way of thinking, the bigger problem is the bad actor, Bonilla Silva says. And yes, there are bad actors and bad cops. But as a system, racism doesn't depend on bad people to remain in place. He also asserts that even police violence enacted by black law enforcement, such as the officers arrested for tasing two Atlanta College students during a May protest, doesn't mean the racial politics of police brutality aren't real. Systemic racism can be enacted and performed by black bodies and brown bodies, says Bonilla Silva. So how can people move away from colorblind thinking? If you're someone who was raised to not see color and you'd like to become actively anti-racist instead, first accept that a major shift in thinking won't happen overnight. One objective is to move away from thinking of racism solely as views and acts committed at the individual level and instead a system of moving parts. Burke says that ongoing self-examination is crucial, and so is believing others' painful life experiences instead of minimizing them to maintain your comfort. I still honor this process. Trying to do this self-interrogation to really think about how I could do better, says Burke. And I think we have to listen to the voices of Black folks, other people of color, and other marginalized folks broadly in all of our spaces. You can also dive into the wealth of great podcasts and books about race in America. Realizing that I don't read enough work by Black authors has been part of my own recent self-examination. Resist the urge to ask a black person in your life to explain things, or worse, expect them to soothe any guilt you may be feeling. I recently heard one anti-racism advocate recommend buddying up with a fellow non-black friend, keeping a text thread for sharing questions and resources to educate each other. What if you're already on board with doing the work, but want to win your frustrating Facebook friends over? That typically requires a big-time investment, Burke says, with a varying payoff. When I was on it, I tried to thoughtfully engage in the right moment with the right person, with the right issue to say, let's unpack this a little bit. And sometimes people would say that that was effective for them, but it takes time. In other words, you need to have ongoing Facebook conversations, not just one. There's no perfect post, no one answer. It has to be two people who are really having a conversation. And even then, it's what people do after that conversation that matters. Every time that someone says, I'm colorblind, you have to tell them, okay, so you have a racially integrated life, you live in a mixed neighborhood, and then they may say, well, my neighborhood is, it's just a regular neighborhood, says Bonilla Silva. You mean white then, again? And then they just get totally discombobulated, cannot articulate the word. Yeah, and then you keep pressing yet to show that their colorblindness is just a set of rules. Because in truth, their lifestyle is often totally white neighborhoods, friends, and associations. As for me, I'll continue to pipe up on Facebook in what I now refer to as the hometown dialogues. But talking with Bonilla Silva and Burke has made me think my limited free time is best spent on more direct action and self-education instead. After all, I was raised to be colorblind too. And discarding that way of thinking means continually engaging with Black people and Black culture in highly imperfect ways. I can't do that part for other white people. I can only help us fumble forward together. It's like we can't get out of our own way, Burke says. It's similar to what Robin DiAngelo has talked about in her book, White Fragility. It all becomes this thing where the comforts and the privileges of white folks get protected instead of Black lives. Our next article is titled, Five Stories That Redefine the Word Family. How do you define family? If you want to be as happy as the folks below, we'd encourage you to see it for what it can be. A marvelous, occasionally messy collection of partners, parents, exes, siblings, babies, and best friends, all bonded by that most powerful glue, love. The first submission is from Judith Tumol. I live in Manhattan with two men. Neither is my husband. In fact, they're in love with each other. One is my best friend, Chris, whom I've known since we were 12, and the other is his partner, Kurt. They've been together for 3 decades. When we were in our mid-30s, I was single and Chris was already with Kurt, but we all wanted a child, which led to a plan. Chris and I would make a baby together. Not the traditional way, we did artificial insemination, DIY style, with help from a sterilized measuring cup, a homemade ovulation calendar, and a turkey baster. After 3 months of trying, I got pregnant in August 2001. Chris and Kurt were driving back from Fire Island, where they were renting a summer house, and I called to say, "You won't be able to take that house next summer because we're going to have a baby." Lily was born in April 2002. When I was in the delivery room, someone asked Chris who he was. He said, "I'm the father." Then Kurt said, "And I'm the other father." Though we all lived in the same city, our apartments were 21 blocks apart, meaning Lily was shuttled back and forth constantly. After about 10 months, we said, "This is crazy." Everybody wanted to be with the baby, which meant we needed to live in the same place. So a month before Lily's first birthday, we moved in together. Amazingly, it wasn't awkward or uncomfortable, probably because we'd known each other for so long. And it didn't hurt that Kurt had a fabulous eye for decoration, although there were some disagreements about which diapers to choose and whether organic baby food was really healthier. 2 years later, we tried for another baby, but I had 2 miscarriages. It was just too emotionally painful, so we all agreed we'd adopt. That's how we got our son Luca, who was born in Ethiopia. Now 5 of us live in the same happy, chaotic 3-bedroom apartment. The kids call Kurt Pappy and Chris Daddy. One doesn't take precedence over the other. Both are their fathers. Conservatives say we're going to turn the kids gay, but I always tell people you couldn't do that if you wanted to. When Luca was 8, we took him to the gay pride parade, and he was like, I'm not gay, I'm hungry, and I don't want to be here. I know it all sounds pretty hip, but we're just like any other family. I'm the control freak, and Chris is the disciplinarian. He hates that I'll make Luca a separate dinner if he doesn't like what the rest of us are eating. For the children, though, having three parents is phenomenal. They have two fathers who will toss around a baseball with them for hours on end, and a mom who will let them stay up too late watching movies in bed with her. And I'm lucky, too. If the kids are driving me nuts, Kurt will take them out for an hour to give me some peace, then come home with a bottle of red wine. Still, our situation definitely confuses people. We were coming back from a family vacation in Costa Rica in 2013, and the customs officer didn't understand why each of the adults had a different last name. One kid had mine, and the other had Chris's. So we started trying to explain. She's my daughter, and they're her father's, and they're a couple, and he's adopted. The guy just handed back our passport, shaking his head and laughing as he sent us through. He said, you couldn't make this up if you tried. Next submissions by Emily Wolper. I was engaged more than a decade ago, but broke it off after an important realization. I was staying with him only because I wanted kids. I'd always been very committed to becoming a mom someday. I'd created my own business and developed a flexible schedule based largely on that objective. So when I said goodbye to my fiancé at 30, I decided that if I hadn't met somebody I wanted to have a family with by 37, I'd go for it another way. At 36 and a half, I was still single. At the same time, my parents were having marital troubles, and I wanted to encourage my mom to create some distance from her marriage. I made a proposal. She'd come live with me, I'd do IVF and have a baby, and she'd be my co-parent. She moved in 2 weeks later. Then, while I was pregnant with my second daughter, Logan, we learned that my younger sister was seriously ill with pulmonary fibrosis, a rare disease that causes scarring and stiffening of the lung tissue. She'd need to be hooked up to an oxygen tank 24/7 and would be unable to work, so she moved in too. We live in a 5-bedroom colonial in a very traditional New Jersey suburb. Nearly everyone on our street is a nuclear family or a retired couple. I call our place the sorority house because it really feels that way. I make eggs for all of us in the mornings, the three grown-ups watch The Bachelor on Monday nights, and we sing a lot of show tunes. My older daughter, Misha, is in kindergarten, and though it's sometimes tough for my sister to make the block-long walk, she's out there to greet her niece at the bus stop in the afternoon as often as she can. She also comes up with little games to get the girls to eat healthy dinners and make sure they know it's okay to color outside the lines. I never could have predicted that this would be my path. While my feelings about motherhood are steadfast, my thoughts on our arrangement depend on the day. Sometimes it feels pretty ideal because I have so many hands on deck, I get to have a mom's night out or work in the evenings and not scramble for a babysitter. Other days it feels like the most confining thing I could fathom, three adult women living in very close quarters. I'll call my girlfriends to chat while I'm waiting at the car wash because that's a rare moment of privacy. I guess we're somewhere on the line between completely bizarre and totally normal. In our society, we're not really raised to think that we'll live with our siblings and parents as adults, although in a lot of cultures, that's exactly what happens. It looks like Americans are headed in that direction, with kids moving home after college and grandparents moving into their children's places instead of retirement communities. I guess you could say our little crew is on the cutting edge. Our next submission is from Donna Scora. In 2014, Florida paralegal Donna Scora wanted something you can't find on Amazon, grandkids. I was looking for a way to spend time with children, she says. My daughter and I are very close, but she doesn't have kids. And for complicated reasons, I haven't seen my son and grandchild since 2013. I tried being a baby cuddler at a neonatal unit in our local hospital for almost 2 years, but it was tough to fulfill the minimum hourly commitment while working. I wanted to be able to give someone a grandparent's love and attention, and I couldn't. So in January 2015, Scora founded a Facebook group called Surrogate Grandparents USA. a place where strangers can potentially become much more. On the page, prospective grandparents across the country offer their services for book reading and cookie making, while parents post photos of kids who need the kind of cheerleading, comfort, and butterscotch candies that only grandparents can provide. Access to the group is by permission only. SCORE reviews each membership request and encourages anyone meeting up in real life to do a background check beforehand. Short bios and locations are shared, and if there's interest from a compatible family, the two parties start messaging privately and take things from there. Currently, the group has more than 3,700 members. Beyond fractured relationships, there are plenty of reasons people join. Distance is a big one, says Scora, now 63. Those with family outside the country might look for someone local. And of course, there's death. People who've had a family member pass away say they're searching for a relationship to help fill a void. Happy beneficiaries regularly post success stories. One woman praises a surrogate grandma's weekly visits and homemade meatballs. Surrogate grandparents show off photos of kid-centric trips to the zoo. The success stories fill my heart, says Scora, and the dynamic serves both sides. I read that grandparents who babysit their grandchildren tend to live longer. Meanwhile, seniors offer kids knowledge and a connection to the past. The effect on Scora has been profound as well. One premise of the group is healing through moving forward, and it's served that purpose for me, she says. At the moment, moderating the Facebook group nightly and holding down a full-time job means she can't devote time to a surrogate grandkid of her own. But Scora looks forward to rectifying that after she retires. Until then, she says, I feel like I'm the parent of a very large community, and I'm so proud of that. Our next submission is from Nicole Fleetwood. My mom and her father moved to Salem, Oregon in the summer of 1972 for his new job. That's where she met my biological dad. I jokingly call it the summer of love. They were teenagers and together for only a few months. When they realized she was pregnant, he couldn't commit to being a dad, so she moved in with her mom in Washington to have me. I was born when my mom was 17. My father met me as a baby, but by then my mother was already with someone else, Dick, who didn't mind raising another man's child. She was too young, though, not ready to be a mother. She'd had a tough childhood and had turned out kind of rootless and wild. Eventually, Dick got custody of me, which was fine. I'd always believed I was his biological daughter. After Dick remarried, my being around just didn't work anymore. So at age 7, I went to live with his parents, who'd always wanted a little girl. Every day they made me feel so cherished, so loved. Then, when I was about 10, they sat me down and told me the truth, that none of them were related to me by blood. I was horrified and confused. I remember thinking, what am I? As a teenager, I became fixated on finding my biological father. I grilled my mother, and she told me everything she knew. His name was Brian Miller, he was from Salem, and he was tall, dark, and handsome. Then, when I was 24, my mom died. It was incredibly tough to lose her, yet I continued my hunt for my father, despite the fact that all I had was a common name and no birth date. This was pre-internet. I even tried psychics and detectives. It was unbelievably frustrating, but I never, ever gave up hope. In March 2018, I took an Ancestry.com test in the hopes of learning a little more about my medical history. The results turned up something else. It was extremely likely they'd found a parent-child match. There was a location, Maui, and initials, BM, Brian Miller. I was so nervous to call him. When I finally summoned the nerve to pick up the phone after a pep talk from my best friend, I started by saying, "Hi, this is Nikki, and Ancestry says we're related." He replied, "Do you know how long I've been looking for you?" All I could do was sob. The story came tumbling out. He'd been searching for decades, making fruitless cold calls, doing internet searches that went nowhere because my mom had changed her last name after getting married. But here we were. We started talking and texting several times a day. I was in the stratosphere. It was total euphoria, like finding the piece to a puzzle I'd been waiting most of my life to solve. My connection to him was visceral and soul deep. 3 weeks after our first call, I flew to Maui to surprise him on Father's Day. His girlfriend and daughter, my half-sister, helped me plan it. I hid as we were driving up and crawled along the side of the house so he wouldn't see me through the giant picture window. As I walked through the front door, he was coming down the hall, and we locked eyes in person for the first time. He was speechless, with a giant grin on his face. In the video his girlfriend took, we're giddy, hugging and laughing and crying all at once. My mascara is a mess. I had father figures growing up, but when I met my dad in person, I finally appreciated the biological bond. I wanted to grab his hand and cling to him like a little kid. Like, don't ever go away again. I'm certain my mother had a hand in bringing us together somehow, and I'm just so thankful. Neither of us can tell this story without breaking into tears. Next submission is from Sally Armstrong. I always knew I was adopted. Talking about it was never taboo. My mom would work the fact into my bedtime stories. But my parents waited until I was 7 years old to hand me a piece of information that stunned me. It was a Washington Post article dated September 6, 1988, about a newborn who'd been abandoned in a hospital bathroom. A janitor had come in with his mop and saw a bundle move on the floor. That bundle was me, clean, fed, and warm, but alone. No security camera had captured an image of how I wound up there, so my birth mother's identity was a mystery. I was put into foster care, and 3 months later, my parents adopted me. I grew up an only child, which occasionally annoyed the hell out of me. I get angry and complain, everyone else has a brother and sister, why don't I? When 23andMe became popular, my husband encouraged me to try it. So for Christmas 2017, we both got the kit. When my results arrived, I was glad to have more info on my genetic makeup and some basic medical facts. But 23andMe wasn't done. A couple of months later, I received an email. The site had found a relative who shared my DNA. When I logged on, there was a name, Sterling, highlighted in purple. And next to that, it identified her as my half-sibling, on my maternal side. I turned to my husband, frozen in shock. My half-sister was even more surprised. She was one of four siblings, none of whom knew I existed. They all were raised by our mom, who hid her pregnancy with me because it was the product of an affair while her husband was stationed abroad in the army. She gave birth, stuck me in a safe place, and was home in time for the 6 o'clock news. She and I still don't have a relationship, and my siblings are not in contact with her either. I've forgiven her, but don't plan to reach out. At this point, it's up to her if she wants to reconnect. But I met my sisters and brothers for the first time last May. And though they were technically strangers, it wasn't strange. These people look like me, sound like me, and have my smile. We made a pact to see each other at least once a month, and we've stuck to it. We send video messages daily, and I vacationed with one of my brothers in Jamaica in September. We're catching up on the past few decades of our lives, the prom stories and favorite movies, and trying to do it as quickly as possible so we can move forward and make memories together. Sometimes I still can't process my joy. I woke up one morning an only child, and I went to bed that night the second youngest of five. Our next submission is from Connie Going. When Davion Only's story made national headlines in 2013, heartstrings across the country were forcefully tugged. The then 15-year-old had spent his entire life in foster care and had made a sorrowful plea at a Florida Baptist church. Adopt me. I'll take anyone, he said. Old or young, dad or mom, black, white, purple, I don't care. And I would be really appreciative, the best I could be. Roughly 10,000 families offered him a permanent home. His foster agency placed him with one in Ohio, and everyone was utterly relieved until the arrangement failed. He was sent back to Florida to age out of the system, says Connie Going, who had been the adoption administrator at the agency and known Davion most of his life. When he called me and asked, "Will you adopt me, Miss Connie?" I said, "Absolutely." Going, 56, has spent more than 25 years working in the child welfare system, and Davion is one of two former fosters she's adopted. When she adopted her son Taylor at age 12, he'd been in more than 47 homes. The boys are part of a speedily growing group. There's a desperate need for foster families right now, says Going. Because of the increase in opioid use and children being removed from homes by social services, they're coming into foster care at higher rates than ever. They're sleeping in offices. More than 120,000 foster children are waiting to be adopted. While fostering may seem intimidating, Going says the challenges are nothing compared to the rewards. I used to look at foster parents and think, I could never do that, she says. And yes, at moments, I've shut the bedroom door and cried. But I'm here to say that you can do this. If you have love in your heart and can offer unconditional acceptance, you will not fail. For those curious about the process, Going offers some sage advice. Number one, immerse yourself. Follow foster mom's social media accounts. Try searching hashtag foster mom on Instagram and join online forums about fostering. Visit dailystrength.org or adoption.com. If there's an in-person informational or support group in your town, show up and ask questions. Number two, prepare to be patient. To become a foster parent, you first must attend training classes. Next, a case manager comes to your house for an assessment and in-person interviews. The state does background checks, and then, if you've met all the requirements, you should get your foster placement. The process often takes around 5 months, and in some states, longer. The barriers and safeguards are created with the kids' well-being in mind. Number three, self-assess. The ideal foster parent or parent should be stable in who they are. If you have a challenging family history that you've processed and overcome, you'll likely understand the kids better. Some of the strongest candidates have parented before, like empty nesters. Number four, accept impermanence. Around half of foster parents end up adopting, but there's still a chance a biological family member could step back in at the last minute. The first goal in foster care is always reunification with the original family. And while I adopted my boys, they are not mine. I share them with their birth parents. I've even located those family members for them because I knew it would help make them whole. Number five, emphasize empathy. When kids act out, remember that it's a result of trauma. Think about it this way. They're so resilient and brave that they're taking the chance to connect with another human being after everyone else has let them down. It's our privilege to step in and make their lives better. The next submission is from Brandy Weichel. Anyone passing my house at 7 a.m. on a typical weekday in 2014 might have wondered why a man in pajama pants was climbing my front steps with a package of sandwich meat in one hand and a blender full of fruit in the other. But for our family, this was morning as usual. The man sporting slippers and smoothie fixings? My ex-husband, Derek, simply crossing the driveway that separated our two homes to help get our kids off to school. When we split up in 2008, Derek and I managed the first year under the same roof, with him in our home's basement apartment. But we struggled to devise a more permanent arrangement that wouldn't distance either of us from our two boys, at the time just 6 and 2. Then, in a blessed bit of real estate serendipity, the house next to ours came up for rent. We hugged in relief. This, we figured, was a kind of post-divorce life we could reconcile, maybe even be proud of one day. Being next-door neighbors for 8 years meant our boys moved back and forth fluidly, no packing or commuting necessary. If a permission slip or baseball glove was left behind, a quick text was all it took to arrange delivery to either front porch. Visible from both kitchen windows, the basketball hoop out back was the midpoint between our homes. Their dad or I could call out good morning or praise a newly mastered jump shot, no matter which of us was technically in charge that day. Our adjoining backyards became a well-worn loop for our sons and their friends during epic water gun battles and games of tag. We liked this arrangement so much that it continued for 4 years after Derek married Amy in 2013. They moved a couple of blocks away in 2018, but not, as you might expect, because the grown-ups had tired of bumping into one another in bathrobes while fetching the paper. In our hot real estate market, the landlord decided to sell the place they were renting. Sure, there were times early on when I stood in the driveway waving a cheerful goodbye, but noticing, with mixed feelings, how much like a family the four of them looked when departing for a weekend away. But those moments were far exceeded by all the bonus hellos our proximity allowed, and by how forgiving it was of our tendency to misplace coats, shoes, and retainers. Plus, we are a family now, the five of us, Amy included. Today, we still cause confusion when all three parents show up to a weekend basketball tournament, but we're fine with it. My boyfriend Ryan and his son and daughter are yet more welcome additions to our lives. No, this wasn't what Derek and I imagined when we started a family, but we're happy with our solution. Our next submission is from Krista Cohen. Genealogist Krista Cohen has been fascinated by family history research since the mid-80s, when she helped her dad enter info about their kin into the home computer. That was all it took, she says. I was hooked. Whether you're hoping to untangle a mystery or get better acquainted with your foremothers, Cohen, who's the corporate genealogist at Ancestry.com, says your first step should always be a mail-in DNA test. But for an extra info boost, check out these sites she uses to fill in the blanks. Number one, Find a Grave. A worldwide community that takes pictures of tombstones and cemeteries, then uploads those photos and transcribes what's on the tombstone. There are more than 170 million searchable memorials containing details about birth dates, death dates, and burial locations. Number two, Fold 3, a repository of military records from around the world. You'll find everything from photos to enrollment cards. Newspapers.com. Small town papers were the Facebook of their day. Search where your ancestors lived and get details on births, marriages, and deaths, and information about charitable acts, political and religious affiliations, and more. Information I found here has helped me break through many research brick walls. Number four, Roots Web. One of the largest free genealogy resources on the internet. Check out the Family History Wiki, which contains guides to interpreting census and immigration records and includes links to state archives, libraries, and other government repositories. The final submission is from Becky Fawcett. Becky Fawcett found her purpose after finding out she was infertile. My husband and I adopted both our children, she says. I was actually in the delivery room when our son came into the world 13 years ago. But given the legal fees, travel expenses, and state-mandated evaluations, the financial toll of that first adoption, about $40,000 in total, was massive. It took every penny we had, she says. I said to my husband, my God, we're so lucky to have been able to make that work. Feeling compelled to give back, Fawcett, then a publicist, hunted for programs giving grants to aspiring parents in the hope of doing some pro bono work. But I felt totally defeated by the organizations I found, says Fawcett. They often wouldn't work with single or LGBT parents or people in interracial relationships and supported only one religious group. I was pretty shocked at the lack of inclusivity. How can you tell someone they don't deserve help because of the God they worship or their marital status? And what did that mean for the kids who'd be great family members if only the money was around? Fawcett dove into online research, wrote up a business plan, and then in June 2007 sent out about 1,300 letters announcing her new nonprofit, HelpUsAdopt.org, which offers grants to all types of families. The idea clearly resonated, as she discovered a week later, when she started receiving envelopes in the mail with checks inside, one for $15,000. The organization has since awarded almost $2.6 million to nearly 300 families. Fawcett, who's also the proud mom of a 9-year-old daughter, stays in touch with many of the families who've received grants. The most emotional moments are when people send me baby pictures, she says. And last Mother's Day, I wrote a Facebook post saying how grateful I was to my children's birth mothers. One grant recipient commented, "I'm so grateful to read your story, Becky. Without yours, I wouldn't have mine." I get goosebumps just thinking about it. Our next article by Elena Nicolou is titled, Santoya Brown Long Has Been Thriving Since Her Prison Release. Murder to Mercy, the Santoya Brown story, a documentary on Netflix, revisits the case of Santoya Brown Long. At the age of 16, Brown Long, née Brown, was tried as an adult and sentenced to life in prison for killing 43-year-old real estate agent Johnny Allen, a man she claims paid $150 to have sex with her. Brown Long, now married, has never denied her crime, but alleges she acted out of self-defense, according to NPR. Following tremendous outpouring of celebrity-driven support and legal aid, Brown Long was granted clemency by the former governor of Tennessee in 2019, 15 years after she was first sentenced. Now Brown is happily married and works as an advocate for criminal justice reform. She will be on parole for the next 10 years. Both laws and social mores have changed since Brown Long was sentenced in 2004 and labeled a teenage prostitute. Today in Tennessee, anyone 18 or younger cannot be charged with prostitution. A Tennessee law passed in 2012 defines any minor who performs a commercial sex act as a victim of sex trafficking. If Santoya Brown were arrested today, she would not be charged as a prostitute. She would be considered a young girl who's involved in sex trafficking, Dan Berman, who directed the Netflix documentary, as well as an early PBS version about Brown Long, said while speaking to NPR in 2019. From Murder to Mercy tracks this shift in perception through the lens of Brown Long's case. The only problem with Netflix's documentary? Brown Long says she was not involved in its making. I had nothing to do with this documentary. I did not participate in any way, Brown Long reportedly wrote in what appears to be a now-deleted Twitter statement. Back in 2011, Brown Long was featured in Berman's PBS documentary, Me Facing Life, Santoya's Story. Berman also happens to be the director of Murder to Mercy. According to the Daily Beast, Berman incorporated interviews with Brown Long conducted for the 2011 documentary alongside new insights from Brown Long's legal team and family members. A representative for Netflix told the Daily Beast that Brown Long will be promoting her book along with Netflix's documentary in an exclusive interview, and her tweet was subsequently deleted. Though she supposedly wasn't involved, Brown Long hopes the film aligns with her own mission, advocating for victims of the criminal justice system like herself. I pray that this film highlights things wrong in our justice system, Brown Long reportedly wrote in the since-deleted Twitter post. Here's what Brown, now 32, is up to. She met her husband, Jamie Long, while in prison. Brown Long married Jamie Long, a 34-year-old musician better known as Jay Long, while she was incarcerated. Long is a former member of the R&B group Pretty Ricky and now works as a Christian rapper. Per an interview on the Breakfast Club radio show, Long also owns a healthcare equipment company. On the same radio broadcast, the couple recounted their unusual meet-cute. Years ago, Long watched the PBS documentary Me Facing Life, Santoya's Story, and recalled, "I felt God tell me, stop and write her," Long said. I told her basically, God told me to tell you you're getting out of prison. To Long's surprise, he received a reply. The couple exchanged letters and met in person 4 months later. When I went in to see her, I knew right then she would be my wife, Long said. His instincts were right. They got engaged 2 years later. I bought my wife's wedding ring while she was still in prison, and we didn't know if she was getting out, he continued. Brown gave her perspective in an interview with Essence. He came along at a point when all my appeals had been denied and I didn't have hope. We prayed through it, and because of him, I started working on my relationship with God. And that's when my federal appeal opened back up, which is unheard of. Today, the couple is thrilled to no longer be separated by prison bars. I really feel like I live with my best friend, Brown Long told CBS News. The couple lives in Nashville. After getting out of prison, Brown Long moved in with her husband to his two-story Nashville, Tennessee home. He had a house ready. I had a closet full of clothes. Thank God he's got good taste, because I don't, Brown Long joked while speaking on a Breakfast Club radio show. The couple celebrated Brown Long's release with, drumroll please, a ravioli dinner. I said, you can have whatever you want, and she said, I'm going to get a can of ravioli, Long joked. Brown Long wrote a book while she was in prison, but it doesn't focus on the crime. Brown Long's memoir, Free Centoia, My Search for Redemption in the American Prison System, was published in October 2019, about 2 months after she walked free. Written while she was in prison, Brown Long's memoir spans from her childhood to clemency. According to a review in USA Today, the memoir devotes only two sentences to the actual crime Brown Long committed. Instead, as the publisher's official description demonstrates, the memoir focuses on Brown Long's spiritual journey and rehabilitation. In these pages, written over the 15 years she was incarcerated, Centoia shares the difficult early life that led to that fateful night and how she found the strength to not only survive but thrive in prison. A coming-of-age memoir set against the shocking backdrop of a life behind bars, Free Centoia takes you on a spiritual journey as Centoia struggles to overcome a legacy of family addiction and a lifetime of feeling ostracized and abandoned by society, the description reads. The memoir was nominated for the NAACP Image Awards in the category of Outstanding Biography Autobiography. She's a vocal advocate for criminal justice reform. Brown Long has been busy since her release. She's gone on a book tour and spoken at college campuses like the University of Pennsylvania, Tufts, and the University of Virginia. Further, according to her interview with Essence, Brown Long and her husband are in the process of starting a nonprofit. All of this is in service of her goal, educating others, especially young women, through her story. She told NBC News that she didn't think of herself as a victim of sexual trafficking until she was in her 20s. Instead, she thought of her pimp, Garion McLaughlin, better known by his street name Cutthroat, as her boyfriend. You meet these young girls who are in these situations, and they don't view themselves as being pimped. They don't view their trafficker as their trafficker. They think, this is my boyfriend. And that's exactly what I thought. I thought, this is my boyfriend, I'm in a relationship, I'm his Bonnie, he's my Clyde, Brown Long told NBC News. While speaking to NBC, Brown Long said there were many other women like her, and she's speaking out for them too. Recently, Brown Long advocated on behalf of Crystal Kaiser, a woman who fatally shot her abuser at 17 and is now facing life in prison. Here was yet another situation where there was a young girl caught up with some unfortunate circumstances who reacted out of trauma, Brown Long told BuzzFeed's AM2DM, and the justice system wasn't necessarily trying to hear that or trying to see that. Law school is on her to-do list. While in prison, Brown Long obtained a degree from Lipscomb University, a private Christian college in Nashville. She told Essence that law school might be next. I'm committed to the same fight that got me free. I definitely think that there's a need for reform, not just in prison, but in sentencing and the way justice is handed out in our country. I'm committed to fighting for all the other people who are just like me, Brown Long said. Our next article by Elena Nicolou is titled The True Story of Rebecca Harkness from Taylor Swift's Last Great American Dynasty. Folklore, Taylor Swift's latest album, is officially out, which means it's time to close read the lyrics and find the hidden meanings. Unlike many of Swift's hyper-personal songs, The Last Great American Dynasty is inspired by the true story of another woman, socialite Rebecca Harkness, also known as the maddest woman this town has ever seen. Swift never met Harkness, the fabulous wealthy choreographer. Harkness died in 1982, and Swift was born in 1989, also the name of one of her albums. Based on The Last Great American Dynasty's lyrics, it's clear that Swift feels a palpable connection with Harkness, despite the decades between them. One major similarity? They share a taste in real estate. She used to own Swift's Rhode Island mansion. This is hardly the first time Swift has written from the perspective of an American socialite. Swift's song Starlight from her album Red was inspired by Ethel and Bobby Kennedy's romantic adventures as teenagers. Swift briefly dated Ethel's grandson Connor and became close to the Kennedy matriarch as a result. Here's what you need to know about the true story behind the last great American dynasty and Rebecca Harkness herself. Rebecca Harkness married the heir to the Standard Oil fortune. She was born Rebecca Semple West in 1915 to a wealthy family in St. Louis, Missouri. A New York Times article described Harkness's unusual upbringing. Her parents hired a nanny for Harkness specifically because she had worked in an insane asylum, and then Harkness went to finishing school where she decided to do everything bad. After a first marriage to photographer W. Dixon Pierce, she married William Hale Harkness, heir to the Standard Oil fortune, in 1947. Together they bought Holiday House, a mansion built in 1930 that sits atop the highest point of Watch Hill, Rhode Island. The lyrics of Swift's song nod to her past. Bill was the heir to the Standard Oil name and money, and the town said, "How did a middle-class divorcee do it?" The couple had three children, whose tragic lives are also described in her biography. The New York Times recalled her disturbing reaction to her daughter Edith's suicide attempts. Her daughter Edith jumped off roofs, swallowed pills, and managed not to kill herself. "How should she do it?" Rebecca Harkness asked. "Is there a chic way to go?" Harkness completely renovated Holiday House, their Rhode Island mansion. After her husband died, Harkness renovated the house she owned in Watch Hill, Rhode Island. Gradually, Holiday House, as the Watch Hill estate was called, began to acquire the character of Rebecca's private salon. With 42 rooms, 21 baths, and 8 kitchens, the house sprawled dramatically against the seawall with a striking view of the Rhode Island coast, a New York Magazine profile of Harkness read. One of the richest women in the U.S., Harkness used her fortune to forge the reputation as an eccentric party thrower that would define her in the 60s and 70s. According to a Publisher's Weekly review of her biography, Harkness once scrubbed her pool with Dom Perignon, which Swift references in the lyrics. Other antics included dyeing a cat green and dyeing chocolate mousse blue. Why not? The Watch Hill estate became a focus of Rebecca's creative life, parts art colony, parts summer resort, the New York Magazine profile said. Harkness was especially devoted to cultivating dance talent. She later founded her own company ballet, Harkness House. She turned a local firehouse into the Holiday House Art Center, offering cultural activities. And she brought her guests around town in her own antique fire engine. We weren't kidding when we said she was eccentric. Today, Swift owns the mansion Harkness once owned. In 2013, Swift bought the legendary Watch Hill Mansion for $17.75 million in a reportedly all-cash deal, per the New York Times. Like Harkness before her, Swift used the house's 700 feet of coastline to throw some headline-making parties. Swift's Rhode Island mansion is most famous for being the site of Swift's annual 4th of July gatherings. Unlike Harkness, though, Swift never tried to install a dome in her backyard as a practice space for ballet dancers. According to the New York Times, when Harkness did that, the neighbors sued to have it removed. Harkness died in 1982 and was placed in an urn designed by Dolly. Certainly, Harkness lived a full life. A few of the highlights: she married twice more, built a ballet theater in New York, studied orchestration, and according to her biographer, spent most of her fortune. When she died of cancer at the age of 67, Harkness was placed inside a $250,000 art piece called The Chalice of Life, designed by Salvador Dali. As the New York Times wrote, there was just one problem. Harkness did not fit within the urn. Not long after the funeral, the top of the urn fell off, leaving witnesses to say, "She's escaped." After that history lesson, you can read the lyrics for folklore's third song with an expert's eye. Here are the lyrics for the last great American dynasty. Rebecca rode up on the afternoon train. It was sunny. Her saltbox house on the coast took her mind off St. Louis. Bill was the heir to the Standard Oil name and money, and the town said, "How did a middle-class divorcee do it?" The wedding was charming, if a little gauche. There's only so far new money goes. They picked out a home and called it Holiday House. Their parties were tasteful, if a little loud. The doctor had told him to settle down. It must have been her fault. His heart gave out. And they said, there goes the last great American dynasty. Who knows if she never showed up what could have been? There goes the maddest woman this town has ever seen. She had a marvelous time ruining everything. Rebecca gave up on the Rhode Island set forever, flew in all the bitch-pack friends from the city, filled the pool with champagne and swam with the big names, and blew through the money on the boys in the ballet, and losing on card games bets with Dolly. And they said, there goes the last great American dynasty. Who knows if she never showed up, what could have been? There goes the most shameless woman this town has ever seen. She had a marvelous time ruining everything. They say she was seen on occasion, pacing the rocks, staring out at the midnight sea. And in a feud with her neighbor, she stole his dog and died at Key Lime Green. 50 years is a long time, Holiday House sat quietly on that beach, free of women with madness, their men in bad habits, and then it was bought by me. Who knows if I never showed up what could have been? There goes the loudest woman this town has ever seen. I had a marvelous time ruining everything. I had a marvelous time ruining everything. A marvelous time ruining everything. A marvelous time. I had a marvelous time. We have run out of time for today's episode of Oprah Magazine. I hope you enjoyed it, and be sure to listen next time. I'm Brandi Spragata, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Oprah Magazine is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.